JEA selects the site for its new headquarters. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, where is JEA moving and why does it matter? You can join the conversation right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, Marcy's Law and its potential impact here in Florida. Plus a conversation with Fox Sports reporter Jennifer Hale on her battle with heart disease. All of that and more just ahead this morning. But first this hour, JEA is staying in downtown Jacksonville. On Tuesday, the JEA Board of Directors announced that they're moving their corporate headquarters to a new location. It's over on West Adams Street near the Duval County Courthouse. Now, this move surprised some observers who had assumed the utility would relocate over to Lot J in the sports complex. That's the site next to the Jaguar Stadium being developed by team owner Shad Khan. David Cotton, associate editor of the Jax Daily Record, joins us now with more about this announcement. David, good morning.
Good morning.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the news from JEA. 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And weigh in on Facebook, too. Okay, so on Tuesday, the JEA board selected a Minneapolis company, Ryan Companies. They will build this new campus, a 9-story office tower, as you report, over on West Adams Street. It's a vacant parcel right near the county courthouse. This came as a surprise to some people. And why is that?
Well, absolutely. I think if you've paid attention to what's gone on over at that utility company for the last 2 years, there's been some pretty bad things, I guess you could say, from a PR standpoint, right? This whole argument over privatization, Aaron Zahn becoming the CEO, whatever your opinion is of that. And in this sort of, I think the narrative with this has been Lot J was in the bag. You know, Shad Khan is a...
The fix was in.
You know, Shad Khan is a very active political donor to the mayor. The mayor has a very tight connection over at JEA. And, you know, there's been this narrative that whatever Shad Khan wants happens. But what I will tell you from an objective standpoint, when you look at the proposals, when you look at the numbers, when you look at issues with contracts and all of these outstanding issues and a lot of the things that they presented yesterday at their board meeting, there was one real clear choice, and this was this West Adams location.
Why was that the best choice?
Well, I think two things. I think, and we just talked about this before we went on air, and the one thing is flooding and sea level rise. You know, both of the other locations, the one near Kings Avenue Skyway Station and the one over at Lot J, you know, those are in areas that are going to be compromised in either a Category 1, a Category 2, possibly a Category 3. This West Adams mm-hmm. Street location, I mean, they wouldn't have to evacuate unless it was a Category 3, Category 4. That's important because you want your utility company to be able to respond and to be actively working.
Sure. What's more important during severe weather?
Absolutely. And right now, the other thing too is Ryan just seemed to have, they seem to be a little bit more responsive. Alan Howard, who is the chair of the JEA board, said, you know, during the last 30 days where they've been openly negotiating with all three companies to get the best offer possible, they said, you know, Ryan Companies was willing to make concessions, willing to return, you know, drafts very quickly. And there just weren't a lot of outstanding issues as they now move into this new negotiation phase.
Did the board perhaps take to heart the criticism that you said the JEA's faced over the last few years, the whole debate over privatizing the utility, the perception among some that the board was packed with cronies, weren't actually going to exercise real independent oversight over critical decisions like this one? Do you think some of that criticism at all played a role in this decision?
That's possible. I mean, these are people too. These are volunteers who are on this board who spend a considerable amount of time. And I do think that they genuinely care for the employees of JEA and the operation over there. And that certainly is a factor. More importantly, though, this was a discussion and an exercise that came from JEA's real estate division, from CBRE, which is leading this search on behalf of JEA. They've spent the last year, and people at JEA have spent the last 4 years working on this project. This was very important to some of the core employees at JEA to get this right.
549-2937, as we talk about the future of JEA with David Cotton of the Daily Record. Here's a tweet from Jim. JEA is to be commended for getting off of coal and their recent embrace of municipal solar. They could help homeowners by restoring the net metering cut that they implemented recently. And so going beyond this news about where they will be physically located, JEA is navigating the brave new world of energy, which, and I say that somewhat sarcastically, it's a really complicated path that they have to walk as they transition off fossil fuels and move more into renewables and an energy mix that is going to meet the needs of this growing city. JEA has been through a lot, and they have challenges ahead. They're also still entangled with a nuclear plant in Georgia that they don't want to be associated with. There's a lot happening around this utility right now.
There absolutely is. When you talk to Aaron Zahn, the CEO of the utility, he refers to it now as the energy business and not the electricity business, because JEA, he wants JEA to focus on, like, let's have this conversation about what is the future of energy. You know, it's not just going to be what we've done normally. So this is why they're expanding with solar. They're building, I think, 250 megawatts worth of solar capacity here in town now at different sites. The water business and the wastewater business continue to be a darling for them on the business side of things, but that doesn't mean that the electricity side or the energy side is doing any better than it was. It's also a reason why JEA is trying to sell down some of its real estate assets. They're looking at about $100 million in real estate sales over the next couple of years, including their current headquarters campus.
And you mentioned the whole controversy over whether to privatize the utility. That is off the table for now. Could it come back? Is this something that the board will take up again, do you think, once the dust is settled from voters speaking pretty loudly about this idea against it?
You know, I would never say never. I don't think right now during this phase that they're going to move in with this new headquarters, I don't know if we hear about it as soon as... I think we hear about it maybe, further down the line than sooner. And I think it's probably rolled out a little bit differently if they try to have that conversation again. Let's maybe see what the value is instead of, you know, a board member leaving and the last thing he says is you should think about privatization, like, and throw everybody off for a loop. I think it would be more of a measured approach.
Getting back to the decision to move over to Adams Street, it's sort of at Adams and Pearl Street, if you're trying to get a visual in your head of where they'll be, a stone's throw from the county courthouse. The decision not to move over to the football stadium was certainly a disappointing one for Shad Khan's company. They issued a statement saying they were wished the utility well, but were disappointed they didn't choose Lot J. And so how does this decision impact what we will presumably soon be seeing around TIAA Bankfield in the way of private development?
You know, it was interesting. Yesterday, the attorney representing Shad Khan's companies and the Cordish companies said, you know, hey, we've got an economic development deal ready to go in 6 days if JEA comes over with us for the rest of Lot J. You look, Shad Khan and the Cordish companies have talked to us for the last 3 years about how bold they are, how innovative they are. You're telling me that if you can't lure a municipal electric company to your big, bold, shiny development, that it's going to fall apart? Jacksonville has a lot of great homegrown large companies that are likely looking for new space and would love to anchor a big corporate, you know, entertainment district. I always thought that it was shooting too low, but Alan Howard said something yesterday that the board chairman that really sparked my interest. And that was, you know, look, JEA's job is not to, and this is, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something to the effect of JEA's job is not to promote one economic developer over another. It's to make sure we're bringing value to customers and our employees. And how does that, you know, benefit them in the long run?
Let's go to your calls about the decision. 549-2937. Duran is on the west side. Duran, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa and David. I have a kind of odd question. I looked at the rendering of the proposed building for new office building for JEA, and it's described as being a 9-story structure, but the rendering looks more like a 13-story structure. And I'm wondering if the parking is integrated. It, you know, the article on your website says that there's parking attached, but I'm wondering if it's actually underneath the office structure. So let me know if, and David, you've probably reported on this, so let me know the facts on that. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So the renderings that you're seeing is what Ryan Companies presented back in February. I would recommend also going to JEA's website and just looking corporate headquarters. They'll send you to, there's a YouTube video of like the whole thing. But yes, Ryan Companies, their deal is the tower, and it is going to be 9 stories. On the other side of that rendering, what you can't see is a new parking garage that they're going to build right next door. It'll be connected by a bridge. It'll be 850 spaces, separate parking for employees and for customers. It'll be really easy to get in and out of.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page. Good news. They made the smart decision considering the stuff that had been happening with CEO Aaron Zahn and the possible privatization. This surprised me. I think that's been the reaction of a lot of people.
It was. I think, and I've had like people text me like, wow, are you surprised? And, you know, if I take my reporter hat off and be like cynical Dave over here, yeah, absolutely. But if you look again at the objective, if you just look apples to apples, this really was the best choice for them.
Let's take a few more calls about JEA's announcement. They are staying in the city's urban core downtown as they move their corporate headquarters. 549-2937. Mark is in. Hey, Mark. Mark in St. Augustine. Mark, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to make a comment that I'm kind of disappointed in the city for not selecting an area of town that could really use a boost as far as economic development, either the Northwest Quadrant or over in some parts of the Arlington area. They could have taken one of the other plots of land they had, sold it, taken that money, purchased some land in one of those underdeveloped areas, and, you know, kind of been the seed that maybe other companies could have grown around. But it just seems to me that, you know, the city is sitting there saying, we're not going to invest in that part of town.
Mark, thanks. David.
No, so that's not true. There's a lot of industrial, there's a lot of commercial investment in the Northwest, North and West side right now. So I don't want to say that the city is not investing there. As far as JEA is concerned, like, this question's been brought up to them several times. Like, why not do this in a part of town? You know, people have said Regency Square, you know, places like that. And they just said, look, we want to be centrally located. We want to be downtown. We want to show that we are committed to downtown development, an area some people say needs economic development as well.
This keeps hundreds, actually, I think it's thousands of workers at the utility in the tight little urban core footprint.
760 corporate employees plus all the people who enter and, you know, various employees that come in and out of there.
Okay, so almost 1,000. So they'll be continuing to go to downtown businesses, eat at downtown restaurants. It's not a huge amount of people, but it makes a difference if you're looking to further develop the urban core.
Look, that is a vacant piece of property right now that people drive by and say, what if? And if you think about, there's some parking garages around there that have retail spaces. There's restaurants already there. Gosh, I'm happy for the restaurants who are in the retail spaces that are there that are going to thrive with more employees down there.
And what will happen to the current JEA tower?
Yeah, so JEA,
which is not in the best shape.
No. And you know, go take a tour of that building if you want to know why it's not being refurbished. Hopefully somebody buys it and, you know, repurposes it. But JEA is going to sell it. In fact, the board chair said yesterday, if someone were to come up to us and buy it now, we'd lease it for the next 3 years. We'd be happy to get rid of it. And, you know, they would say, look, if someone wants to spend the money to redevelop this building, by all means, do it. But, you know, I envision by 2022, 2023, that building is no longer in the skyline.
David Cotton, so another bulldozer deal. David Cotton of the Daily Record, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still to come later in the hour. Robert Arley White and his Raw Talks, how you can go see that. And up next, will Marcy's Law help victims of crime in Florida or create new problems for police? We'll explain here on First Coast Connect. Back in a moment.
Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right.
Hi, I'm David Luckin, station manager of 89.9 FM WJCT. Thank you to all that supported our spring radio drive, Radio Uninterrupted. Unfortunately, we did not reach our goal of $60,000, but it's not too late. You can still support us by calling 353-9528 or visit us online at wjct/donate. And thank you.
Get ready to explore the outdoors on International Migratory Bird Day at the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Saturday, April 13th at 10 a.m. Join us for a great day exploring the outdoors and learning how to preserve and protect the habitat that migrating birds rely on and many birds call home. This fun, free family event is hosted by WJCT, the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Temuquan Park Service, and Florida Park Service. To learn more, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best down-tempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. It was hailed as a victory for crime victims in the state. Last fall, Florida voters approved Amendment 6, also known as Marcy's Law. This measure says victims have the right to privacy. Specifically, the law prevents making public records that could be used to locate or harass a crime victim or their family. But the law has also triggered a drastic change in law enforcement policies. As one example, last week, Jacksonville police stopped saying where some local crimes have occurred and who the alleged victims are. What does this mean? Well, with more, here's Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times Union. He's been looking into how the implementation of Marcy's Law could be having some unintended consequences. Andrew, good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
And joining us by phone, former judge and Marcy's Law for Florida lobbyist Paul Hawks. Paul Hawks, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And it's 549-2937 to talk about Marcy's Law. Andrew Pantazzi, let's start with you. This law passed easily. Voters approved it as a constitutional amendment. It's intended to protect victims of crime, giving them a right to privacy. That seemed like an easy choice for most voters to make. At the same time, you found some complications with the law, which you've been writing about in the Times Union. What are you finding?
So Amendment 6 was one of the CRC proposals. It was 1,400 words total, and the portion dealing with victims' rights was about 1,300 words. A lot of this has been seen played out in other states already. There have been nearly identical proposals that have passed other states that have had similar unintended consequences. The first thing that I think the public might care about is the Section 5, which deals with victims' right to prevent disclosure of any information that could be used to identify, locate, or harass the victim or the victim's family. That word could is very broad with what that could mean, because anything could be used to identify or locate them if you've got someone who's capable of doing so. So different agencies have been applying the law in very disparate ways. Barry Richard, famous lawyer of Bush v. Gore, who represented Bush in that case, as well as who has been general counsel to the Florida Bar, issued an opinion at the request of Senator Lauren Book, who is probably the biggest advocate for Marcy's Law. So he issued an opinion that said, basically, you don't have a choice. You have to stop disclosing victims' identities as well as victims' addresses. And so what that means here is, say you've got a rash of burglaries in your neighborhood. Say each of these houses are being burglarized. That means the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office cannot tell you that there's a rash of burglaries in your neighborhood, because they would be revealing information about the victim that could be used to locate them under this interpretation of Marcy's Law.
So if you want to research a neighborhood or learn more about a trend, you will not be as easily able to do that now under this law. Is that correct?
Correct. Under this interpretation of the law. What happened in South Dakota, there was a lot of things that went wrong in South Dakota with the implementation of Marcy's Law. And a lot of law enforcement who were really protesting against it. And the state considered a full repeal of their version and ended up amending it in response to the problems they faced. Among those problems was just an inability to investigate crimes, because a victim includes corporations. So if Walmart is victimized, if someone steals from Walmart and they have footage from Walmart where they're trying to get people to help, you know, JSO can't just go on Facebook and say, hey, there's a robbery at Walmart. Here's a photo. Can you help us solve this without getting permission from Walmart? Which means what? Do you have to go to Walmart board of directors? Do you have to go to the Walmart corporate headquarters? What constitutes that permission? And then when you're trying to think of what it means to be family, does that mean you also need permission from the like corporate family of Walmart? I mean, there's a lot of implications in the law with how it was written.
We reached out to JSO. They sent us a statement about Marcy's Law, letting us know that they are taking proper steps to comply with it. They're reviewing it. And also, until legislation provides uniformity on how it should be handled, proper steps will be taken, so we are in compliance with the amendment. And so, Paul Hawks, lobbyist for Marcy's Law, let me ask you your reaction to this. Concerns about implementation from the law and a seeming entreaty from the local police saying that they could be possibly waiting for more legislation to provide uniformity on how it should be handled. Does the law need more guidance for implementation in Florida, do you think, or not?
Well, I think that your question is a little bit broader than the previous answer. But yes, of course, I think that the law would benefit from implementation. For instance, the law allows victims to opt into certain rights. How do they do that? A statute would tell them how that they do that, so that the judges would know, defense attorneys would know, state attorneys would know that the victim had opted in to certain rights. The law provides that victims will be notified of their rights, and that there'll be a card printed to tell them of their rights. Who prints that card? Who designs that card? A law would tell them that. But as far as the other problems, as far as privacy goes, I think that there's a distinction that needs to be made, and that is, what is generally in the public realm available to anybody just because they want it, and what's available to government in order to perform their functions. For instance, I think it's clear that if law enforcement felt that in order to prosecute someone or to apprehend somebody, they needed to release some information, that's different than just making it available generally for the public. And so legitimate law enforcement purposes, legitimate government purposes, those kinds of things would not be included in the prevention. And as far as reporting that this neighborhood has high crime, clearly that could be reported. That doesn't identify any particular victim. And in a lot of places where law enforcement has given Marcy's Law real meaning, it has worked exactly as it was intended. In the bank shooting, some of the victims did not want their family members identified when they were murdered, and some did, and some chose to do it themselves. That's exactly how Marcy's Law is supposed to operate.
But Judge Hawks, Section 5, the language doesn't have an exception unless the government is doing like a job of trying to put out information for a good purpose. I mean, it only says the right to prevent the disclosure of information or records that could be used to locate or harass the victim or the victim's family, or which could disclose confidential or privileged information of the victim. It doesn't give like an out if the police want to put out information like there was a robbery at Walmart. Can you help us solve this?
Let me ask you too, Paul Hawks. We also have a statement from the Florida First Amendment Foundation asking for more guidance about this from the legislature. They're concerned that some law enforcement agencies might over-redact incident and investigative reports. What about that? The legislature's in session now. Is this something that they could possibly take up next session?
They could. I'm expecting in this session that they may not, because they are busy with implementation on some other items that they, and so this one that they have looks like they probably will pass. I wanted to respond a little bit to confidential and privileged. Confidential and privileged are terms of art that do have meaning in the law. We know what privileged information is. We know what confidential information is. So, for instance, if you are a victim and of potentially embezzlement and there's bank account numbers, we know that those bank account numbers are confidential under Florida law. So that we would take extra steps to make sure that did not become public.
But that didn't change with Marcy's Law. What did change was the earlier part of Section 5, which was not about just confidential or privilege. That's tacked on after an or clause. The earlier part was disclosure of information or records that could be used to locate or harass the victim or the victim's family. And that could word is very broad, because at this point, law enforcement agencies have to foresee a realm of possibilities of what information could be used that would allow someone to identify a victim.
And that could probably benefit from an implementation bill where they talk about, the victim's name. Clearly, if I have your name and I do a Google search, I can find out quite a bit about you probably fairly quickly within just a matter of seconds. And of course, the information is information that could be used to harass and locate. So law enforcement, we had a question, for instance, a question came up, the Tampa General Hospital had an individual came to the hospital, individual died, they sent it to the morgue, they sent it to the ME for an autopsy, and the medical examiner wasn't sure if he could release the identity of the person after they determined it back to the hospital. Well, of course he can.
Let me ask you too, Judge Hawks, as a follow-up, here in Jacksonville, two men were recently exonerated after more than 40 years in prison for homicide they didn't commit. Critics of Marcy's Law say it could create chaos in the state's court system. It could lead to some innocent people being wrongly convicted just based on the way it's going to be implemented and confusion around the law. It passed by let me just ask you this. It passed by a razor thin margin. Is it fair to say that there are unintended consequences to this law, like so many that passed by ballot amendment, while it was well intentioned, that there could be unforeseen consequences that could also cause some damage?
Well, I do think the legislature could file an implementing bill, and I would support that. And we have been encouraging the legislature to do that, to make sure that there are no unintended consequences. But I do not think that Marcy's Law creates the opportunity for people to be wrongfully convicted just because it says that victims have some rights. I mean, the rights that they usually point to when they say that is the reporting requirement on appeal, for instance, is one of them, where after a capital case, and there's lots of capital cases besides murder, I mean, cap sex battery is a capital case, and there's lots of murder cases that don't get the death penalty. But if they're not final within 5 years after the appeal has been final, after the appeal has been filed, then there's a reporting requirement. It doesn't say that the appeal has to be completed in 5 years. It says that there has to be annual reports given to the legislature as to why the appeal is not complete. So if it's because we don't have enough attorneys working on appellate matters, if it's because we don't have enough translators, if it's because clerks are moving too slow on getting the records ready, the legislature will have that information and can respond. And so when you measure something, it's because you care about it, to quote Governor Bush. But the other aspect that they use is that the state attorney can now ask for a speedy trial. Well, the state attorney was allowed to ask for a speedy trial under the old statutes. It was so complex, it was almost unworkable. And this one here does not say that the state attorney gets to ask for a speedy trial whenever they want to. It says the state attorney can ask for a speedy trial in good faith.
And we'll have to leave it there. And running up against a break. But Paul Hawks, former judge, Marcy's Law advocate and lobbyist, thank you for sharing your insights with us about this. Also here, Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times Union. Read more about this on Jacksonville.com. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, she's a popular NFL and NBA sideline reporter. You've seen her on Fox Sports.
I'm Jennifer Hale, and we're getting you all ready for game time tonight. We've got Robin Lopez's road to the NBA, our Honeybee Spotlight, and a look at this new era of Hornets basketball from team owner Gail Benson.
She seems the picture of health, but recently Jennifer Hale started experiencing health problems. And at the age of 38, she was diagnosed with heart disease, a condition called dilated cardiomyopathy. Hale is healthy today because of swift medical intervention, but heart disease is the number one killer of women in the U.S. Knowing the signs and symptoms can save your life. I spoke with Jennifer Hale about her medical journey, a preview of a talk she'll give here next week at WJCT. Let's listen. Jennifer Hale, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me today. I really appreciate it.
So you've got so many fans from regular viewers of Fox Sports and seeing you on the NFL sidelines. You seem the very picture of health and vigor. So I think people were surprised to hear that a couple of years ago you started feeling fatigued and had some shortness of breath. What did you initially think was going on with you?
I was very surprised as well. Initially, I thought that I just needed to suck it up, to be honest with you. I'd been noticing some of the symptoms, the fatigue and the shortness of breath towards the end of my NBA season. But that's not completely unusual. It's a long season. Football runs right into basketball. When it finally ends, it's been a 9-month marathon. So I chalked it up to work and just being a little wimpy. And then normally when the season ends, I'll take a week and I'll sleep in, rest a lot, and then feel like my old self. And I never bounced back. I never stopped sleeping that summer.
And then you started having more serious symptoms, right? Some swelling in your feet and your legs?
I did. That came pretty close to when I was finally diagnosed. I will say the fatigue and the shortness of breath got worse and worse over the summer. And I went to two different doctors. One of them ran all my blood levels, said, well, you're low in vitamin B and vitamin D. Well, at the time, I was 37 years old, so approaching 40. And that's something that a lot of women, certainly at that age, deal with. So I took the supplements they told me and figured I just need to wait a few months for the levels to correct. And when the shortness of breath continued to get worse and worse, I am asthmatic, but adult asthma. So I have an inhaler that I use maybe 10 times a year. I was using that thing 5 times a day, especially at night. I kept waking up feeling like I just sprinted the last, 200 yards of a 5K, just gasping for breath. So I went and had a chest x-ray, and it didn't show anything. So this all kind of verified to me that it was just my mind. I was just being, like I said, a wimp. And then the beginning of September, that's when the swelling started. And that kind of told me, okay, no, this really is something, and I've got to figure out what's going on.
And so you were eventually diagnosed. You had an echocardiogram. What did it reveal?
My heart had gotten all the way down to 16% pumping function. Dilated cardiomyopathy was my diagnosis, and basically that means the left side of my heart had stretched out considerably. If you think of your heart like a rubber band, it pumps by popping back and forth, by pumping, like you might pop a rubber band and it bounces back. And because my heart had stretched out so much, it wasn't able to pump and close and do that step back motion that pushes blood throughout your body. So, 16% function, and that's why I was experiencing the swelling in my feet, ankle, legs, and even it had gotten up to my waist, because my body was focused just on getting blood to the vital organs, and it wasn't, it was leaving out the lower extremities.
Mm. And you're not even 40 yet, getting this diagnosis. And so I think your story is so powerful for women to hear, because 1 in 4 female deaths in the U.S. are attributed to heart disease, the number one killer of women. Your medical intervention made such a difference for you, life-saving, it sounds like. It's my understanding you got medication, a defibrillator. Those worked so well that you don't need a heart transplant, although at one point I think you were on the list to get one. Is that right?
Absolutely. So dilated cardiomyopathy has essentially a 5-year life expectancy. Doctors did tell me, because of my age and because I don't smoke, I didn't even eat red meat. That might be more like 7, but they weren't sure. So most people need a heart transplant if they want to extend their life. So I did go ahead and get on the heart transplant list. And looking around for different specialists, I just felt like there had to be more information. There had to be more alternatives. So eventually I was recommended, by the grace of God, to the head of the heart transplant unit for Louisiana, since I was getting on the heart transplant list. And he's the one who said, you know, there is this medication. It's not effective for everybody. Probably about a third of people respond well enough to the medication to come off the transplant list. And the frustrating thing is going to be it works very slowly. They call it heart remodeling, and it's about a two-year process. So we were going to have to go, if I wanted to try the medication, which I did, we would go ahead and do tests and the paperwork and all that to get on the transplant list, because the chances were more in favor of the medication not working. And then it would just be a very slow process of remeasuring my heart every 6 months to see what effect the medication was having. And I have to say, I'm so blessed, because I really felt like I could tell the medication was working just a few months in. I felt better. My energy level felt better. I would still get shortness of breath walking up steps or carrying a suitcase, but I wasn't waking up at night from a reclining position out of breath. And it took 2.5 years until finally they said, yep, your heart is back to the normal level. It's the low end of normal, but it's normal. So you can come off the transplant list, and we can officially say medication's working for you. You mentioned the defibrillator. So they had wanted me to take 6 months off of work initially. And this diagnosis alone was so devastating. I felt like if I took 6 months off of work and just sat in bed in a room with four white walls, which is what they recommended, I would go crazy. I think the mental battle of this is almost just as important as the physical. So I told them I was going to try to continue working. I'd worked all the way through having my heart get down to 16%. So hopefully now that I was on the mend, surely I could keep working. And that's when they suggested, well, if I was going to do that, in the event my heart stopped, they wanted me to wear a defibrillation vest. And it monitored my heart function 24/7. And in the event, which thank God I never needed it, but in the event the heart did stop, it would defibrillate and shock my heart back into beating. So I wore that vest for about 8.5 months until my heart got up to 35% function.
Oh, my goodness. Your story is so riveting. And it's important to note that almost 65% of the women who die suddenly in this country of coronary heart disease don't have any symptoms at all. But some women and men have symptoms that they might brush off or potentially not take very seriously until it's too late. With your story, you received the medical intervention you needed and it made all the difference. So what advice do you have for people who need to be, you know, they need to be made more aware that heart disease is so much more common than people realize, particularly for women? And what are some signs people need to be aware of? What advice do you have for other women?
Absolutely. Know your body and trust your body. I don't want to turn anyone into a hypochondriac, but deep down, I knew something was wrong. That's why I went to 2 different doctors. And I should have kept pushing. I should have gone to a third. I should have trusted myself that this is not normal. But I think as women, we stay so busy and we put everyone else's needs ahead of our own, whether it's family or work. And we have to take our own health very seriously, just as seriously as we take theirs, or we can't continue to be caretakers for them. Also, I really encourage everybody to write down their family medical history, whether it be heart disease, cancer, anything. Write down who was diagnosed with what, at what age, and what symptoms. It turns out I had a family history of heart failure and cardiomyopathy. My father, uncle, and grandfather all passed from it, but it was always the males, and they didn't talk too much about it. So in my mind, I thought they had passed from heart attacks, and it wasn't until the cardiology team, the transplant team, really insisted that my mom go back and find whatever medical record she could from my father and my uncle's death. My grandfather's wasn't really available. And going back through those, sure enough, it mentioned cardiomyopathy in there. And heart failure and a heart attack are two very different things. And that was a big mistake that I made. I didn't differentiate between the two. A heart attack is sudden. It's when the blood supply is cut off from the heart, generally from blocked arteries. And heart failure is gradual. The heart muscle just gets weaker and weaker, deteriorates more and more until it stops. Had I recognized the difference and had I told doctors throughout the years that I had a history of cardiomyopathy, maybe they would have suggested tests. There's a very simple blood test. BNP is the shorthand for it, where they can test for a certain hormone. And it's a relatively cheap test. That hormone is not normally present in a healthy body. Your heart secretes it when it's in trouble. So my brother and sister now have that BNP test every year, annually. And that's the way for them to check to see if their heart is beginning to show signs of distress. I have that test now every 6 months. So it's an easy way to keep tabs. And again, if I'd looked at that family history, even though I'm female and they were all male, I think I would have put the pieces together much sooner.
Sure. That's something women need to think about. If there's heart disease in your family, if it's the men in your family, don't discount the fact that you could be at risk as well. Heart disease is the number one killer of women in America. And so this is all such wonderful and life-saving information, Jennifer. We thank you so much for sharing this with our listeners. And we're really looking forward to hosting you next week here at our WJCT studios. Thanks, Jennifer Hale. A pleasure to have you on the show. I hope you enjoy your time here in Florida. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Sisisky-Cleppinger Annual Endowed Lecture for Women's Health. Presenting Fox Sports reporter Jennifer Hale. This is coming up next Wednesday, April 10th at 5:45 p.m. here at WJCT Studios. Get your tickets now. This talk is free and open to the public. Go to womenslecture.eventbrite.com to register. And in a moment, raw talks from Jacksonville's own storyteller, Robert R. Lee White. We'll be right back.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington remind you to act fast, whether it's water, mold, or fire damage. ServPro of Jacksonville South, 721-2230. Like it never even happened.
Shen Yun Performing Arts revives 5,000 years of divine culture through classical Chinese dance and a live orchestra. Shen Yun returns to the Jacksonville Times Union Center on April 24th and 25th for two shows. Learn more at shenyun.com/FL.
The acting head of the FAA, Daniel Elwell, says pilots should have known how to override the software system linked to two deadly crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX. Some pilots say he's wrong.
I really can't agree with much of what acting director Elwell stated.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The debate over pilot training and whether that was a major factor in the crashes. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. Reparations is not just about money. Reparations is about repair, amends, and a reparations settlement can come in as many forms as necessary.
What reparations for slavery could really look like in the United States. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Democratic presidential field includes two veterans. A former Marine and current congressman says he might run too, motivated by his newborn daughter.
I don't want her growing up in this country with a commander-in-chief that we fundamentally can't trust, where she doesn't have the same opportunities that a little boy growing up at the same time would have.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, they're called Raw Talks. Two special performances this weekend only from master storyteller Robert Arley White. Get it? Raw, R-A-W. This also features his performing partner, Charlotte Mabry. And
yeah,
we've got a preview right now as Bob White, who, of course, many know, headed up the Cultural Council for many years.
100 million years.
Joins us now. Hey, good morning.
Hey, how are
you? I'm good, and it's good to have you.
It's lovely to be here.
Okay, so when I hear the title Raw
right,
Talks,
yeah,
I kind of think you're going to spill a little tea maybe and get
maybe
a little raw
maybe
on your show.
Maybe.
Are you?
Maybe, but I'll tell you what, these are the two things you can count on that will make the show raw. It has what my mother would call language.
Oh.
Robert,
so you work blue, in other words.
Well, no,
this
I wouldn't say.
This is adults only?
No. Well, it's not for the children's ears, but
okay.
I wouldn't say it's blue necessarily because that implies something else. But there, you know, I'm an artist, so I have access to the whole palette of language, right?
Okay.
But the other part of Raw Talks that I think makes it really special is that as you check in, you're asked to write down a question for me to answer, riff on, respond to, whatever. In fact, I brought a couple of sample questions from the Raw Talks we've done.
Let me ask them right now.
Well, you can do it, but
I'm
sort of flying without a net, if you know what I mean. And that makes it a little bit raw, too.
Okay.
You know, so is there
something? Here's a good one.
Yeah.
Where would you like to be a fly on the wall?
Oh, in the mayor's office.
Oh, yeah?
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
That would be a good one, yeah.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Let me see.
Yeah.
How did you first meet Charlotte Mabry? And how long have you worked together? Now, she will be performing with you at this.
Yes, she will. And let me tell you what, I don't think I could do this by myself, and I certainly would not do it without her. She is amazing. And we met, golly, maybe 30 years ago, and we met. It was a meeting that had been arranged for us so that we could talk about performing together. And we specifically were going to work on a piece by Sam Shepard called Tongues, and we in fact did it. And out of that working together relationship came this astonishing friendship, partnership. There's a line in a Sam Shepard play where one of the characters says, "I can smell your thoughts before you think them." And that's how we work together. I don't know that there's ever been a crossword between us, but we've done really fun, experimental, delightful, difficult, hard things. And I love working with her. There's nothing I'd rather do than being on stage with Charlotte Mabry. Nothing I would rather do.
It's going to be a great show. And with decades in the art and culture world in Jacksonville, this is just sort of
hundreds of thousands of
the next chapter for you.
Yeah.
And this is being done at Babs Lab,
yeah,
which is a great performance space.
Yes. Barbara Colicello.
In the Cork Arts District.
Yeah. Barbara Colicello has been so generous with me and so encouraging. And I have to say, too, that Laura, none of this would happen without Laura Evans. She's been on me for years to do this. She is, in fact, my executive producer. And Barbara has made the space at Cork available this Friday and Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And it is a real good time. And it's, you know, it's 70 minutes. There are songs. There are prepared pieces. There are the questions. There are stories. So it moves really, really, really fast. And before you know it, you're out and it's early enough, you can still have an evening.
How long have you been developing Raw Talks? Is this brand new?
My whole life.
Your whole life.
This is stories from all over the place. And I would say this is my whole life. And I need to say, too, that with respect to the questions,
I have yet to come up with a question that I can't answer or have a story for. And the reason for that is because I am old and I lived a life crowded with incident. You know what
I
mean?
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
Okay, here's what I have one for you.
Okay, hit it.
If you could change one thing about Jacksonville, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about Jacksonville, it would be that everybody would know and appreciate what a dynamic arts community we are, because we have things in this city that do not exist anywhere else in the state, and I would dare say the region. And along with that, I mean, hand in hand with that would be a real celebration of education in our town. I think that needs to happen.
He's Robert Arley White. And by the way, August 12th has been proclaimed Robert Arley White Day in Jacksonville.
Yeah.
You have your own day now.
I know. It's kind of
amazing.
Are
they going to give you the key to the city on this day?
They would have done that if they were going to, but oh well.
One day you'll get it.
I know it.
But in the meantime, go see Raw Talks this Friday and Saturday.
It's going to be fun.
Two shows only. Performances at 8 o'clock at Babs Lab. That is in the Cork Arts District. At 603 King Street in Jacksonville. Get your tickets now online at BarbaraColicello.com and go see Robert Arley White and also featuring Charlotte Mabry.
Yes.
Thanks for being here.
Have a great show. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Our director is Michelle Corum. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. And on tomorrow's show, a conversation with the former mayor of Charleston, Joe Riley, visiting Jacksonville to talk about what makes a great city. That's tomorrow. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Luckin, station manager of 89.9 FM WJCT. Thank you to all that supported our spring radio drive, Radio Uninterrupted. Unfortunately, we did not reach our goal of $60,000, but it's not too late. You can still support us by calling 353-9528 or visit us online at wjct/donate. And thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.